ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the Muslim holy month of Ramadan is about to begin, with civilians in Gaza still facing catastrophic conditions. Also, as Tasmanians get ready to vote, both major parties face accusations of pork barrelling. And 50 years after their breakup, the influence of English soul and funk band Samande lives on.
My children were connecting with the music before I did, because they were listening to that kind of music. I wasn't so much listening to it. I mean, I was practicing law at the time.
We begin this evening with the conflict in Gaza. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan is about to begin there, but there's no sign of a ceasefire. And as the humanitarian crisis worsens, the push for countries to reinstate aid to the United Nations Relief Works Agency, UNRWA, is growing. Rima Cheer filed this report.
In the southern city of Rafah, hundreds of thousands of people are trying to salvage what they can to prepare for Ramadan. Sabah Al-Hendi is originally from Khan Yunus, but she was forcibly displaced and she's at the market trying to find food for iftar, the meal that breaks the fast each evening during Ramadan.
The mood right now moves you to tears. No one is spotted with signs of joy in the rise. Prices are soaring. All homes are sad. Each family has a martyr and there are those whose houses have collapsed. Our hearts are bleeding. There is no Ramadan atmosphere.
The UN estimates over 500,000 people are at catastrophic levels of starvation in Gaza. The crisis has countries like Jordan and the United States racing to get aid in, but that's extremely difficult. The US has begun parachuting thousands of meals into northern parts of the Gaza Strip. Jeremy Conendike is the president of Refugees International and a former USAID official in the Biden and Obama administrations. He says it's not about how the aid is getting in. The real problem is how it's being distributed.
Has acknowledged that the movements, particularly to the north, are still being routinely blocked and obstructed by the Israeli government, by the Israeli military forces. And there are instances where even when convoys are approved by the government at a central level, then when the trucks go to a checkpoint, the individual troops on the checkpoint will still hold them up. So we're not in the kind of context where that last mile distribution is possible at scale.
There's growing international pressure on countries to restore funding to the UN's largest agency in Gaza, UNRWA. Australia was among the countries to suspend its support in January after Israel accused 12 UNRWA staff of involvement in the October 7 terror attacks. UNRWA released a report in response, alleging that some of its staff detained by Israeli authorities were coerced into confessing they were linked with Hamas. The UN is waiting for the results of its own investigation. Canada, Sweden, and the European Commission have decided to restore their funding, and Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says the government will make its own decisions soon. The opposition's Home Affairs spokesman, James Patterson, who is in Israel, wants the government to wait.
My view is that Australia should only restore its funding when it is confident that there is no risk of any of that funding finding its way to Hamas and that UNRWA has dealt with the issues of its employees' alleged complicity in the atrocities of 7 October. And if we were to try to resume our support for UNRWA before then, we would have to have very strong guarantees that Australian money would not be misspent.
He doesn't think that cutting UNRWA's funding has led to this logistical challenge.
The major obstacle to get aid in Gaza is not funding for UNRWA. It is the physical obstacles and operational obstacles to getting the aid in. Of course, more aid would always be welcome, but the main obstacles are not the amount of aid, but the access of that aid into Gaza, and particularly the distribution of the aid within Gaza, which is very challenging operationally.
Scott Anderson, Senior Deputy Director of UNRWA Affairs in Gaza, doesn't agree. He says the cuts to UNRWA have had a major impact.
It comes at a time that's very critical for operations in Gaza in particular. We have 2.2 million people that are affected by the current conflict, including 300,000 people trapped north of Wadi Gaza. I have seen firsthand children that are suffering from malnutrition in the north, and it's just an incredibly frustrating and despairing situation.
While it's a big decision for the Albanese government and the pressure is building internationally, it doesn't appear the government is under much pressure within Australia. Simon Welsh from research firm Redbridge Group doesn't think questions around the government's funding of UNRWA will have political blowback.
The average voter right now is sort of so consumed with their own cost of living pressures and crisis, but they are obviously engaged with what's happening in Gaza. As there was distress around October the 7th, the big concern that sort of the average punter really has is more around not wanting to bring aspects of that conflict back into Australia. So they really want to see the Palestinian community here and the Jewish community here looked after, supported and sort of cohesion within our own country.
That report from Rima Cheer. The horrors Palestinians are facing are casting a shadow on the holy month of Ramadan, which is supposed to be a time of blessings. Iftar dinners are held each evening at sunset to break the day's fast. But many Islamic organisations in Australia have cancelled their public iftar dinners and will instead donate funds to humanitarian aid programs in Gaza. This report from John Daly.
At a mosque in Perth's city centre, worshippers take a quiet moment for midday prayers. They're preparing to observe Islam's holy month, which is usually cause for celebration. The local imam, Muhammad Ilyas, says this year a pall hangs over Ramadan as the humanitarian crisis worsens in Gaza.
We can see what's happening on the ground. People are showing us, through mainstream media. This has made us very sad and very helpless. What can we do? It's not enough that they should be bombed to death and then told to evacuate and even bombed again in those safe zones. Now they're pushed like herded, like animals, like cattle. So this is not the humanity that we know. And that's why this Ramadan, we are saddened, but we pray to Almighty Allah and we pray for our brothers and sisters in the world. And we would like that we should not have double standards.
Nasser is a local worshipper, and he says the plight of Palestinian civilians is weighing heavily on him and others.
We have the suffering, the pain in our hearts because of what's happening, and we have to feel with them. We have to support them in whatever we can, following the legal framework, following our entitlements by law, Australian law. And we want the Australian fellows, non-Muslim Australian fellows, to join us and to feel what we feel exactly, because Australia is a country of human rights. That's what we believe in, and that's why we migrated here.
In Adelaide, Imam Kamran Tahir is also preparing for the holy month. His prayers will be different this year.
It's heartbreaking. It's definitely heartbreaking to see all these innocent lives being lost. And naturally, it tears you up inside and it wants you to lay down in prostration even more. And with this blessed month, where there's a huge, huge focus on prayer and trying to raise your awareness as well as your relationship with God Almighty. So naturally, with that pain in heart, your prayers are done with a lot more empathy. So I think that definitely will be a part of this month for myself as well as the rest of the Muslim community.
Kamal Dabusi is chief executive of the Australian Federation of Islamic Councils. He says events throughout the month will be more sombre this year. The Federation has decided to cancel its big iftar dinner, where it usually invites the public to break the day's fast with worshippers.
We've actually cancelled our iftar dinner and we've decided to donate the funds to UNRWA, the United Nations Works and Laws and Relief Agency, for the Palestinians. And increasingly a number of organisations and people are doing the same thing. Rather than holding public iftars, they have decided to donate their funds to those that are in need. And I know that's a tough decision for some organisations to take, because there's also value in the community coming together at this blessed month, and we don't detract from any of their decisions, but there are a number of organisations, and we are one of them, that have decided to cancel our events.
Kamal Dabusi hopes Muslims across the country will take some solace from their family and faith this month.
The community is in pain. I can't put it better than feeling the pain. The pain is just everywhere in the community, and that pain leads to anger and resentment, and that is growing in the community as well. And the apparent helplessness that we feel as well. So we do hope that people take the time in Ramadan to connect to their spirituality, to their religion, and find some strength in that to help them overcome this absolute despair that a lot of people feel. And, you know, we all need to take the opportunity to look after ourselves and our families whilst trying to look after those that are overseas as well.
Kamal Debussy from the Australian Federation of Islamic Councils. That report from John Daly. With the Tasmanian state election less than a fortnight away, both major parties are being accused of trying to win votes by promising taxpayer-funded grants to community groups. Pork barrelling is nothing new, of course, but accountability experts fear it's becoming more common in Australia and may threaten our democracy. This report from Alexandra Humphreys.
That's a very good hit, Rob. Oh, no.
Baseball Tasmania held its grand final in Hobart on Sunday. At the same time, the Tasmanian Liberal Party announced the community and sporting organisations will receive new grants if the party is re-elected. They're worth about $19 million in total. But there are criticisms of how the organisations were chosen. The organisation needed to have already discussed it with a Liberal candidate, who then put in an application to the Liberal Party on their behalf. Baseball Tasmania's president Callum Upchurch says no one ever told him there was a process underway.
It's disappointing, as it's like this is sort of, you know, the first I've heard about it, so it's sort of sinking in a little bit. Yeah, it's a bit disappointing. It feels like it's kind of done, not on the slide, but, you know, behind closed doors kind of stuff. You don't really know, you know, don't know about it. And all of a sudden it's, you know, a surprise. So I think it would be more handy, it'd be more convenient if we were approached, or, you know, we knew that it was happening, so we could then get our, you know, ducks in a row.
Mr. Upchurch says there are plenty of projects Baseball Tasmania would be keen to pursue if it had the money.
We don't have our own function area, so we're actually running out of two sheds, like the garden sheds for a canteen, and also we've got like a bird aviary sitting there for scorers. You know, while it's, you know, it's good for comfort and stuff like that, it's just not a, you know, it's not a great look.
The Tasmanian Liberal Party has promised varying amounts for different electorates. There's $4.7 million worth of grants in the central electorate of Lyons, but only $2.2 million in the electorate of Clark in Hobart. There's money for clubroom upgrades, gun clubs, netball courts, and plenty of new synthetic greens for bowls clubs. Liberal leader Jeremy Rockliffe is defending the process.
We're upfront, honest, there for everyone to see. They reflect, of course, local members and candidates interacting with their community.
Tasmanian Independent Upper House MP Meg Webb wants funding like this handed out in an open process that ensures fair access and no party political involvement.
We're seeing an in-house secretive process that relies on people knowing a candidate who can put them forward for some public funding. It's not appropriate.
The taxpayer-funded grants, to be handed out if the Liberals win government, were announced by the party's campaign director, who isn't up for election. The funding won't be assessed by a government department, but Parliament will need to sign off on it.
The fact is they might be good projects, but other projects might be better. Unless there's an apolitical way of assessing, you can't tell.
Stuart Hamilton is a director of the Accountability Roundtable, a body aimed at keeping Australian politicians accountable to the public.
A government or a would-be government making decisions based not on looking at the merits of proposals across the board, but looking at proposals that are biased towards their own electorates, their own members, etc., etc. All that achieves in the end, apart from a little bit of glory in the short term, is make people have a view that government is, if not corrupt, at least not to be trusted.
Tasmania's Labor Party is also promising grants as part of its election campaign. It issued a call out to councils and peak sporting groups for projects to fund last year and will announce the recipients before Tasmanians vote later this month. The party has promised to have its pledges rigorously assessed, but Stuart Hamilton says not enough is known about Labor's process.
One would want to see what the criteria were, what the actual process for soliciting applications was and how the decisions are made before you could give it a clean bill of health. It doesn't seem to be quite as lacking in merit as the process for the Liberal side, but it's by no means out of the woods yet in terms of integrity.
He argues the rise of pork barrelling across Australia is a significant issue for democracy.
It's one of the many areas where we believe democratic government is under threat in Australia because of the pressure on governments and parties competing for votes and using means that are dubious in their integrity. The attempt, frankly, to bribe electors to vote for one side or the other by issues that are, by matters that are, might be attractive to the electors, but actually simply suborn the process of good government.
Stuart Hamilton from the Accountability Roundtable. That report from Alexandra Humphreys. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, one film dominates this year's Oscars. Scientists are concerned the health of the Great Barrier Reef is reaching a tipping point. The natural wonder is in the grip of its seventh mass coral bleaching event since 1998. And it's not just Australian reefs that are struggling. American authorities are warning the world may soon see its fourth global coral bleaching disaster. Annie Guest has more.
As someone who measures changes in marine life, Professor Greta Petzl is devastated by more bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef.
It's extremely distressing to see that this has happened again for the fifth time in 8 years. I know a lot of scientists that are experiencing what we would call eco-distress or eco-grief, and a lot of other people as well, because it really is such a fundamental change to our natural world.
And the ARC Future Fellow at the University of Tasmania says many in her profession have a bleak outlook.
Many scientists are saying that the Great Barrier Reef has already reached a tipping point. You cannot have a natural system that needs an absolute minimum of 10 years to recover, more like 20 or 30 years to properly recover between mass bleaching events. You can't have that happen every second year and have the reef thrive and recover in the way that we know it now.
Aerial surveys over two-thirds of the reef have shown most corals in shallow water have bleaching, where heat-stressed coral expels the algae that gives them their vibrant colours. It's all part of a global pattern of higher-than-usual ocean temperatures.
Ocean temperatures have been the warmest on record for almost an entire year.
Average water temperature increases can be about 1 degree, but it's variable across the ocean. While on land, there's been 12 months of average temperatures 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. And Professor Petzl, who's also an author with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, points out heat is damaging reefs worldwide.
The US government agency that looks at coral reefs has put out an indication that they think we're on the cusp of the fourth mass global coral bleaching. So that's where we see bleaching through, you know, all of the oceans of the world that have reefs, or many of them.
Extraordinary bleaching has happened for the first time on the world's most southern reef at Lord Howe Island off New South Wales. And last northern summer, the Caribbean experienced record coral bleaching. Fellow IPCC author Professor Leslie Hughes is also monitoring the damage around the globe.
Bleaching's occurring basically across every coral reef in the world, particularly in places like the Caribbean. And in Australia, of course, we're seeing bleaching right from north of Cooktown to the southernmost points of the reef, such as Lady Elliot Island.
The Emeritus Professor at Macquarie University is an expert in coral biology.
The corals are the structure of the reef. The coral skeletons provide the habitat basically for everything else. There are a lot of organisms that live in the corals or eat the corals.
And those fish and other marine life could be losing a vital source of nutrients.
When you lose basically the housing of the reef, you lose lots and lots of other species as well. So it's it really is a coral reef is the habitat for thousands and thousands of other creatures.
PM invited the Environment Minister, Tanya Plibersek, to be interviewed, but her office referred us to her earlier statement saying the federal and Queensland governments are investing more than $4.7 billion in the reef between 2014 and 2030. Ms Plibersek also says the federal government has legislated a path to net zero by 2050 and is working to reduce Australia's carbon emissions.
Any guest with that report. Now to the 96th Academy Awards in Los Angeles. And a spoiler alert, we are going to tell you who took home the coveted Oscars. Oppenheimer was the big success of the night, winning 7 of the 13 categories it was nominated in. The blockbuster biopic about the American physicist who developed the atomic bomb scooped Best Picture, Best Actor and Best Director. 4 Australians were nominated, but all went home empty-handed. This report from Anna Pikett.
Live from the Dolby Theatre at Ovation in Hollywood, please welcome tonight's host, Jimmy Kimmel.
It was a night of few surprises, celebrating the best films of 2023 with nothing but praise for a certain 3-hour atomic bomb drama.
And the Oscar goes to Christopher Nolan Oppenheimer.
After already bagging the top prize at the Golden Globes, the Directors Guild of America, as well as the UK's BAFTA Film Awards, no one in the film industry was shocked when the biographical thriller took home 7 Oscars. These included some of the technical awards like film editing, cinematography and original score, but also Best Picture, Best Actor for Cillian Murphy, Best Supporting Actor for Robert Downey Jr. and for the first time in his career, Christopher Nolan scooped Best Director. He was quick to thank his wife and fellow producer.
Thank you for those who've been there for me and believed in me my whole career. The incredible Emma Thomas, producer of all our films and all our children. I love you.
The award for Best Actress went to Emma Stone for her role in dark comedy Poor Things, where she plays a young woman brought back to life by an unorthodox scientist. The movie won a total of 4 gongs, the others being Best Production Design, Best Makeup and Best Costume Design. Emma Stone had less success with her costume when she had a wardrobe malfunction on stage.
My dress is broken. I think it happened during I'm Just Ken. I'm just Ken.
Ryan Gosling was a standout, performing the Barbie smash hit I'm Just Ken, along with 65 Kens and legendary Guns N' Roses guitarist Slash. Australian entertainment journo Catherine Tulich is based in LA. She says although Barbie only won 1 award, it was the film of the night.
Even though Oppenheimer was the big success story, I think Barbie is still the star of the show because there were so many references to Barbie and it was just so wonderful. Billie Eilish won Best Song. That was the only award that Barbie ended up winning, but nobody could help mention it pretty much throughout the show.
But Catherine Tulich says it was a disappointing night for the 4 Aussie nominees who all missed out.
I mean, Margot Robbie was obviously nominated as a producer of Barbie, so she was one of the nominations. Tony McNamara, who's an extraordinary screenwriter, was nominated for Poor Things. He did not win. And we did have 2 Australian short films nominated, but unfortunately they lost out to Wes Anderson, a rather famous director, who decided to do a short film this year with starring Benedict Cumberbatch. So that was probably pretty hard to beat, that one.
It was a historic night for some as Ukraine won its first ever Oscar with Best Documentary 20 Days in Mariupol and the UK winning Best International Film for The Zone of Interest. The relevance of the Oscars has been called into question in recent years with the astronomical rise of streaming. Kim Masters is the editor-at-large for The Hollywood Reporter. She says this year's Barbenheimer box office success has been nothing but great news for the Academy. She says the future of the movie industry is uncertain as the legacy studios struggle to compete.
all of them tried to compete with Netflix, and all of them have been hemorrhaging money. And we've seen Fox disappear into Disney, and it's just kind of a label now. Paramount is definitely in deep, deep trouble and is expected to be sold and broken up for parts. And even Warner Brothers Discovery is in terrible condition because of the debt that they have put when they put those companies together. These places could vanish. You know, it's shocking because the Hollywood we know is really going, we don't know where.
Following the fallout and negative press from the 2015 ceremony when the Oscars announced a set of 20 all-white acting nominees, questions were asked about whether the Academy had a diversity problem. This led to new diversity requirements for this year. Writer Cord Jefferson took home the Best Adapted Screenplay Prize for American Fiction and told the audience Hollywood has an important lesson to learn about diversity.
There is an audience for things that are different, and a story with black characters that's going to appeal to a lot of people doesn't need to take place on a plantation, doesn't need to take place in the projects, doesn't need to have drug dealers in it, doesn't need to have gang members in it. That there's an audience for different depictions of people's lives.
Oscar-winning writer Cord Jefferson, that report from Anna Pikett. Well, you may not have heard their name, but you've probably heard their music. London soul and funk band Samande broke up in the mid-70s after recording three albums. 15 years later, unbeknownst to the group, their records were being used as backing tracks for hip-hop artists like the Fugees and De La Soul. Now, riding a new wave of popularity, Samande is touring Australia for the first time. This report from Oliver Gordon.
Samande's story starts in South London. Bassist Steve Scipio says he and fellow founding member Patrick Patterson lived on the same street as kids.
We became friends in 1963, had a mutual interest in music and started developing that interest.
After many years of perfecting their craft and playing gigs, the Caribbean immigrants got their big break, touring the US with soul artist Al Green. Guitarist Patrick Patterson explains.
We did the Apollo in Harlem, which was, as I say, a very heady time for the band. I wouldn't say it was wholly unexpected because we always had ambition and aspirations. So getting that opportunity was really very, very important for Samande.
Samande's albums did well in the US, where they toured twice. But back home in England, they were ignored by a music industry Patrick Patterson says wasn't ready to embrace black British artists.
I think it's fair to say that the music industry in the United Kingdom was not fair to us. It was not fair to all the black bands of the time. It was difficult to get access and difficult to get exposure.
The band retired, but their music would take on a life of its own in New York City, where hip-hop and disco DJs were cutting up their records and turning them into something new. Hip-hop pioneer DJ Jazzy J used Samande's albums to create some of the first examples of a hip-hop beat.
Play that one part on this side, mix it on that side, mix it back and forth. Now we got something. And that was like the beginning stages of what we know right now is hip-hop.
Getting It Back, the Samande Story, is a new documentary tracing the band's unique journey through the music industry. Eventually, the music would be sampled by giants of hip-hop, De La Soul, the Wu-Tang Clan, and in this Fugees track, The Score. It's time I settle the score. By this point, Samande bassist Steve Scipio had long given up his dreams of being a touring musician and was working as a lawyer.
My children were connecting with the music before I did, because they were listening to that kind of music. I wasn't so much listening to it. I mean, I was heavily practicing at law at the time, as was Patrick.
But the renewed interest in the band led to a resurgence in popularity. And now, 50 years after first forming, Samande is touring Australia for the first time, selling out shows across the country. Guitarist Patrick Patterson is grateful for the journey.
The most important thing, as you would know, is the fact that the hip-hop community found in our music something that inspired them. I am very happy about that. We're both very happy about that.
And they made great music, you know, utilizing the music that we had made. It's a great thing.
And even though the founding members are now in their later years, Patrick Patterson says Simande's story is far from over.
We've done what is clearly half of an album. So when we go back to the United Kingdom, we're going to complete that mission.
Guitarist Patrick Patterson ending that report from Oliver Gordon. And you can see more on Simande on tonight's edition of 7:30 on ABC TV and iView. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You'll find all our interviews and reports on the PM webpage. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hey, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It was meant to be a sign that all is well, a beaming photo of the Princess of Wales and her children. But then the big news agencies pulled it, concerned it may have been manipulated. Today, Royal Watcher for the ABC, Juliet Reedon, on the royal family's tight control of its images. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.